you kind of take a look at it and think, well, this must not be it, because I'm not sure I can fit through that first section. That's what I like about slot canyons. I have to know the night before how much pizza to eat before I go into those things. This is the Dear Bob and Sue podcast, our stories of adventures and misadventures as we traveled to all of the U.S. national parks and public lands. I'm Matt Smith.
And I'm Karen Smith. We are the authors of the Dear Bob and Sue series of books. Today, we're talking about 10 of our favorite places in southern Utah beyond the Mighty Five.
The Mighty Five are the national parks that most people focus on when planning a trip to Utah. And as amazing as these parks are, there's so much more to see and do in southern Utah. We have a long list to share with you of our favorite places and public lands.
Many of them have views and hikes that are every bit as spectacular as the national parks, but they're more off the beaten path. If you're planning a trip to Utah, it's really worth adding some of these places to your itinerary.
To kick things off, we discuss why we wanted to record this episode and shed some light on the lesser-known locations. And at the end of the episode, we'll answer a question from a listener in our mailbag segment. I like the subject of this episode.
You do?
Yeah. Utah, southern Utah, because we love southern Utah so much. And everyone's so focused on the national parks.
They are.
And which are fantastic. And we were too, I think, when we first went to southern Utah. But there is so much more there other than the national parks. So many great places, public lands, places, parks. And that's what we're going to talk about in this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But we should at least say a little bit about those five national parks.
Well, we should. And if you were wondering about the title of this episode, which is Beyond Utah's Mighty Five, 10 Amazing Public Lands. Utah's Mighty Five is just another sort of a phrase that they call the five national parks in Utah, which are Zion, Bryce Canyon, Arches, Capitol Reef, and Canyonlands. Those are the Mighty Five.
The national parks in southern Utah are known for their amazing landscapes. When you think about it, like arches, you're never going to find as many natural arches in one place as Arches National Park. And the vistas of Canyonlands, both the overlooks of the confluence of the Green and Colorado Rivers in the north, and the views of the Needles in the south, and of course the hoodoos of Bryce, and the scenic drive of Capitol Reef, and the beautiful Valley of Zion. It's about these incredible landscapes.
Mm-hmm. It is. There's no place like it. I think Utah is probably the state we have visited the most and the place where we've had the most adventures and misadventures, wouldn't you say?
Right. Yeah. And some of those adventures have been on foot. Some of them have been driving some of the back roads.
Mm-hmm.
The roads can be a little bit bumpy in some places to get to. Some of the destinations. Recently, we had a situation where we were on this incredibly muddy, steep road, and fortunately, the truck did such a fantastic job that we're getting a little bit more confident about doing some of the road-based adventures. We still haven't done the Burr Trail, so the Burr Trail's in the central part of southern Utah. Got to do that.
And that kind of scary Schaefer Trail that comes out of Canyonland. So that's on my list, too. I have a huge list. You know that, right?
Right. So we're going to have to do those. I guess that's another part of the story is, even though we have been there so many times, the list is pretty long of the things we still have yet to do.
It's huge. Every time we go and we check something off the list, we talk to someone there, whether it be a ranger or someone who lives there or another visitor, and we find out more things that we didn't know existed, and we add them to the list. So I swear the list never gets any shorter.
Right. But today we're going to talk about, in this episode, we're going to talk about 10 of the places that are outside the national parks in southern Utah. They're just great spots to visit and great adventures to have.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there's a lot more than 10. We always struggle to narrow it down. We started with 20, and because we try to keep this podcast to an hour, there's just no way we can talk about all that. So we'll, of course, in future episodes, we can talk about some of the things we left out because we know that there's some other great stuff to see.
And as we have new adventures, we'll talk about those on future podcasts.
Absolutely. Now, we had thought a month or so ago as we were recording new episodes that we would not be talking about COVID-19 because we want to keep these episodes evergreen. And if someone listens to them 3 years from now, we didn't want to date it by talking about that. But it does come into play because these 10 places we're going to tell you about, as of right now, May 2020, some of them might be closed. When we tell you that the campgrounds are open all year, some of the campgrounds are closed. So today's episode is for future planning down the road.
Right. And that's a theme with pretty much everything we talk about in terms of places to go. Things change.
Mm-hmm.
Roads change. Conditions of parks change. And so rather than try to put in these podcasts exact hours when the visitor centers open or what trail is open at a given time or what's the right directions, just do that research before you go. These days, it's just so easy to find that information. Just Google it or go to the website of that particular park and you'll get the most updated information.
That's right. And hopefully we'll get back to Utah before too long. We had to cancel our March trip and I'm really missing it, missing our adventures. It's time to go out and get lost or, I don't know, just go back out to Utah and have some adventures again.
Yep. Looking forward to it. So here are 10 other places and public lands in southern Utah, besides the 5 national parks, that are great things to add to an itinerary if you're traveling in the area. So we're going to talk about 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And Karen, what is the first one?
The first one is Monument Valley Navajo Tribal Park, which is it is in Utah, but it sits on the Utah-Arizona border. So a big chunk of it is also in Arizona. But it's such a great place that I wanted to make sure we talked about it today.
Right. Southeast part of the state of Utah. And my favorite thing about this park is it reminds me of the Roadrunner cartoons. I cannot look at the Monument Valley without thinking of the Roadrunner going off a cliff and falling slowly and then a cloud of dust puffing up.
That's your reference. It reminds me of the Wild Wild West. So there were a lot of cowboy movies filmed there with John Wayne riding off on his horse. And it's just an iconic landscape. It has sandstone buttes and it just looks very Western to me.
Now, it's on Navajo land. So mm-hmm. It's a Navajo tribal park. And I believe they prohibit all forms of climbing now.
Yeah. The other thing we should note is that visitors are not allowed to go anywhere in the tribal park without a guide, except for one particular hike that we'll talk about in a minute. So you can't just park your car, get out and start wandering. So the other thing that you might recognize the landscape of Monument Valley from is the movie Forrest Gump. And the scene where he's running down the highway and he finally decides to stop running, that's one of the highways leading into Monument Valley. It's actually Highway 163.
Right. In the movie, he is running north.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're driving north to south to the park, there's a place where you'll see this spot. I don't know if it's marked on the highway
anymore.
It is
now. Is it? It says Forrest Gump Hill or something, and yeah. There's a little pull-off.
And I will say, be careful when you're driving down 163, because people will stand in the middle of the highway with traffic coming and take photos and not watch what's going on around them. They've improve that highway some, and the visibility is pretty good, but mm-hmm. just watch because people People reach that point, they get all excited, and I've seen people just walk right out in front of cars.
Oh, sure. And people, they do handstands on the road with this gorgeous scenery in the back. They, you know, they do jumps in the air, they skateboard. So it's kind of a thing now. But we have a picture of it from the road as well, so we'll make sure and post that on our website.
And we've only done a few of those things ourselves.
we did not skateboard.
No, we don't. I don't have a skateboard.
So you can drive on 163. And you're sort of skirting the perimeter of the actual tribal park, and that does not cost anything. If you want to make the turn into the tribal park, the last time we were there, it cost $20 per car, and that was for up to four people in your car. And that takes you into the park itself, where most of those sort of iconic buttes are located.
Now, a lot of people, and we do this all the time, there's a tendency to want to skip the visitor center because you want to get into the park and see it. This particular park, one tip we have for you is the visitor center itself. There's a patio right off the entrance to the gift shop and area, which is possibly the best place in the park to get photos of some of these 1,000-foot butte monuments.
I thought you were going to say one of the main reasons to go in is because there's an incredible gift shop that has beautiful Navajo jewelry of all kinds, rings, necklaces, bracelets, earrings, pendants. I mean, gorgeous. I could spend hours in there looking at all the beautiful native jewelry. So that's another thing to check out if you're there. But once you're inside the park, there are really two main things to do. And one, if you want to hike, there is a 4-mile trail called the Wildcat Trail, which will take you around West Mitten Butte. It's one of those buttes that looks like a mitten.
Because it has a little thumb sticking out.
Yes. And it's the only trail you can hike without a Navajo guide. And we did that, and it's a great hike.
Yeah, if you like open desert hikes. And it also gives you a great opportunity to see the butte, obviously, from 360 degrees as you're walking around it. So that's a lot of fun.
Yeah. And then the other thing to do is once you're inside the park, there is a 17-mile dirt road that's a scenic drive, and it will take you past a lot of these, you know, really cool rock formations, but it's a rough road.
it's pretty rough. We've driven it before, but we've gone to the park other times and started down the road and just, I don't know, I was worried about our beer all exploding in the back, but it shakes you pretty good.
It does, and it gets very dusty. Now, if you don't want to drive it yourself, there is an option. They have tours, and they have these open-air vehicles that you can – I'm assuming it costs something. I'm not sure about that, but you can go on a tour with a Navajo guide on one of their vehicles if you don't want to drive. Great park, absolutely stunning to see.
Yeah, I think it's worth, certainly worth the trip south to see that.
Absolutely.
Now, a little bit further north of that is an area that has kind of three interesting places that we'll talk about, which is Gooseneck State Park.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a gooseneck is an area of a river where the river is going so slow, or the elevation change is so low, that the river kind of wraps itself back around. So it does these squiggles, and those little squiggles, when it does that, if you look at them from above, it looks like a goose's neck. And of course, when these things are 1,000 feet tall and you are at an overlook to oversee them, they're just spectacular. So there's Gooseneck State Park.
Mm-hmm. And it's called Goosenecks because there are two of them next to each other. It's a double. I think the technical term is entrenched meander, and there are two of them at Gooseneck State Park that were formed by the San Juan River that flows through that area. But Goosenecks is a quick stop. It costs $5 to get in. You drive basically right to the overlook, get out of your car, and you look down, gosh, like 1,000 feet. You look down at this river and these goosenecks, and it's really spectacular. The distance of these two goosenecks is 1.5 miles, but because the river is so curvy there, it actually flows for 6 miles to make its way through. So it's definitely worth a stop to see. And they do have a campground if you're interested in camping there. I think it's like $10 a night. But anyway, it's not, as I said, it's a quick stop. It's not too far out of the way if you're going to Monument Valley. Definitely worth it to see.
Now, close by Goosenecks State Park, just a little bit north of there, is an area called Valley of the Gods. And it is, I would say it's similar to Monument Valley. Of course, it's not in a Navajo tribal park. This is U.S. public land.
Right, right.
And again, it has, there's no entrance fee. There's no ranger there checking cars as they go in. There's a 17-mile dirt road mm-hmm. that meanders through these monuments. And again, the main attraction there are these buttes that rise from the desert floor in spectacular fashion. And so that's the main feature.
Right. And it is very remote once you get out there in the 17 miles and there are no services. So you want to make sure you've got plenty of gas. And it is managed by the BLM, but there isn't any kind of visitor center or anything out there. But it's a really pretty drive.
And we've been out there a couple times. We do see RVs out there. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the process is if you get a permit to go out there. But some people love the desolation. They go out with their mm-hmm. RV and stay out there for a week and just kind of by themselves. Mm-hmm. Spectacular spot. Now, when we visited there, we drove through the Valley of the Gods and then went to Goosenecks State Park. But there's also a cool attraction right next to these two places, which is called the Moki Dugway. And we didn't know what Moki was or Dugway was, but it turns out that Dugway is the name for a road that carves through a cliff and makes its way up a cliff. And so this Dugway is a 3-mile section of State Route 261. Now, what's so incredible about this is it climbs, 1,000 feet mm-hmm. up from the floor of the desert up to Cedar Mesa?
Yes.
And winding switchbacks. We were kind of scared to drive it for the first few trips to southeastern Utah.
I know.
And we skipped it. But then we finally did it.
Well, the reason we did it was because when we went to Goosenecks State Park, the woman who took our $5 at the little ticket booth, we asked her about it. We said, you know, we want to do it, but we just don't know. Is it, you know, what's it like? And she said, oh, she does it every day. She said, you won't have any trouble. So that gave us the confidence to try it. And she was right. It looks more intimidating than it actually is.
Well, but I will say this. We were there on a sunny, dry day, and with a lot of the roads in Utah, southern Utah, if it's wet, it's a whole different deal. So mm-hmm. I just know that if it's a dry, clear day without any ice or snow, it's really not a big deal.
Right. And the views from the top are stunning.
Right.
And now there are warning signs at the bottom of the road. And one of the things that they recommend is that vehicles should be less than 28 feet long and less than 10,000 pounds in weight. And I think, you know, as far as RVs and trailers go, you just, you know, it's up to you.
We saw a small RV mm-hmm. make its way up without any problem. But
yeah.
Certainly up to you. So that's the second public land area of our list, Goosenecks State Park, Valley of the Gods, and Moki Dugway, all close together.
Right. As you're taking that road up, it's that State Route 261 up the Moki Dugway, that puts you up in Bears Ears National Monument, which we're going to talk about in a minute. And specifically, we went that way to go see the next park that's on our list, which is up there, which is Natural Bridges National Monument.
Was it the first national park site in the state of Utah?
Yes, it was the very first one of all the NPS sites. It was the very first one. It was designated by Teddy Roosevelt in 1908. So it's been there a long time.
Right. And I think when it was designated, the roads to it were very primitive. It was hard for people to get there. Now, of course, today there's a nice paved highway that goes close by, and then there's a turnoff that good road that goes into it and a scenic drive So it's easy to get to.
Mm-hmm. But it sits at about, it's at high elevation. It's about 6,500 feet up on that Cedar Mesa Plateau. So the cool thing about natural bridges are the three natural bridges. And I'm going to butcher these names, but I'm going to try to pronounce them. They're called Asipapu, Kachina, and Owachomo.
Right.
There is a paved 9-mile loop that will take you to overlooks for all three of these natural bridges. So if you don't have a lot of time, you can just drive the loop. It's beautiful. You can stop, get out of your car, and look down and see all three of these bridges.
But if you have more time, the best way to see these bridges is from down below. And there's a series of trails that kind of all loop together. You could do them all. It would be kind of a long way. We've done two of the loops, but they take you down into the canyon.
Mm-hmm. And it was beautiful. So as Matt said, there's a few options. You can do a full loop, which is almost 10 miles, and that will take you down and past all three bridges, back up, you cut across the mesa back to where your car is parked. The one we did was a little bit shorter. We did the Sipapu to Kachina bridge. And that loop was about 5.7 miles. That's when we did. And it was fantastic.
Right. It's a little steep going down and mm-hmm. then a little steep coming up. Mm-hmm. But once you're down in the – is this White River?
White Canyon.
White Canyon, mm-hmm. which also just runs for miles and miles through mm-hmm. Utah. But this particular area, once you're down in the canyon, you're hiking along the – creek/river. Mm-hmm. So not a lot of elevation gain once you're down there.
No, and it was beautiful because there was forest down there. There were a lot of trees. I think indigenous people used to live down there as well. But so the hike down, there were a few ladders that you had to descend. Probably nothing more than what, 8 feet maybe tall?
Yeah, they weren't tough.
Right. And then there were some kind of steep steps that were carved into the rock. So, you have to kind of navigate that to get down there, but it is the best way. And then you're actually standing under these three incredible bridges looking up at them, which is a wonderful way to see them. So if you have the time, take at least a half a day and do one of those hikes down into the canyon to see the bridges.
And they have a pretty good campsite by the visitor center.
Mm-hmm. I think they have like 13 campsites in the campground.
Yeah. It looked like a nice, well-kept campsite.
Mm-hmm. Also, one more thing. Not only was it the first NPS site, but Natural Bridges was the first international dark sky park. So apparently, we were not there at night, unfortunately, but apparently the stars there are incredible.
Well, it's so far from anywhere mm-hmm. that I'm sure the sky is very dark and the stars are beautiful mm-hmm. when they're out, when there's no moon. That was the third one. What's number four?
Number four is Bears Ears National Monument. And that, again, is in the same area. We drove through Bears Ears to get to Natural Bridges. And coming from that direction, which would have been south to north, you can actually see why the park is called Bears Ears, because there are these two towering buttes that right. rise up out of the landscape that look just like bear's ears from far away.
Yeah, we'll put a picture of that on our website.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's only kind of one little stretch of highway where you can see it just right. Mm-hmm. And we have a photo of that.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. And now Bears Ears is co-managed by the BLM, which, if we didn't mention this before, is the Bureau of Land Management, the Forest Service, and five local American tribes. Now, it used to be, Bears Ears used to be huge, the area, but in 2017, the boundary lines were redrawn, and Bears Ears, the land in Bears Ears was cut by 85%. So now they separated into two units. One unit is Indian Creek, and the other is Shosh Jaw.
And that area, that 85% that was cut, it's not like it turned into private land and there's homeowners or things like that on it. It's still public land. It just doesn't have the same kind of designation or protection mm-hmm. of a national monument. But there's still interesting things you can do in that entire original area of the national monument. And that access really hasn't changed.
Right. As a matter of fact, the Valley of the Gods that we talked about, that used to be in Bears Ears. And that was one of the pieces of land that is no longer in that particular national monument. But Bears Ears, that whole area is just very remote. And unless you're going to drive on the two highways that, you know, kind of run through this area, you're going to need a high clearance vehicle to go into some of those back areas.
Right. Or hiking by foot.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are some interesting – this whole area has thousands of ancient archaeological sites hidden all throughout. And some of them are close enough that you could hike to. Some of them aren't, and you would need a side-by-side or some other kind of high clearance vehicle to get back in there.
Mm-hmm. Or you could hire a guide. There are guide services that will take you back in there. But one that we were able to hike to and is absolutely stunning is called House on Fire, one of these archaeological sites. It's located in the South Fork of Mule Canyon. And the hike is only about a mile and a half to get to this particular...
From the trailhead. Once you start hiking on the trail.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So the cool thing about House on Fire, and of course, the reason it has that name is because when the sun is shining down on it and the lighting is just right, it looks like flames are shooting out of this cliff dwelling.
Right. If you get the photograph just right and the lighting's just right, and it's not always just right. I think we have a photo. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll put that on the website.
Mm-hmm. But it was amazing to see. And then the same canyon, if you continue hiking for another 2.5 miles, you'll come across another 7 to 8 additional ruins that are sort of tucked up in the cliffs.
Yeah, when we went to House on Fire, we were driving that State Route 95. We were driving it west out of across Utah. That highway, there's a stretch of it. It's called the Bicentennial Highway. And it runs through Bears Ears, and the whole stretch of highway, it's a scenic byway.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just beautiful. The scenery, the landscape changes as you go east to west or whichever direction you're driving. But yeah, that's another thing to keep in mind if you're in the area. That's an incredible highway.
Yeah, the scenic byway runs for 121 miles. And so Hanksville is sort of on its border to the west. And then U.S. Route 191 borders it on the east. But there have been times where we didn't have time to stop and get out and hike anywhere, but we just drove through on that highway because it is so beautiful.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Oh my gosh. And on both sides, the scenery is stunning. So highly recommend that if you've got some time, and especially if you're headed over to like Hanksville, Capitol Reef, you just cut through on that highway and it's beautiful. So one other national monument we want to talk about that's down in the same area, you can do all of these things that we've mentioned so far on the same trip because they're close enough to get there, is Hovenweep National Monument. And Hovenweep has very well-preserved remains of stone dwellings of ancestral Puebloan villages.
It's in southern Utah, right on the eastern border with Colorado.
Right, right. And this area was once home to 2,500 people. And these archaeological sites that are preserved here were built between 700 and 800 years ago.
We have been there a couple of times in the off season when there's just nobody there. Now, of course, if you go in the off season and the visitor center is closed, you miss out on that.
Right. Well, the first time we went, there was a monsoon. So we went into the visitor center and it was raining like hell. We couldn't even, you know, you couldn't even walk 10 steps without getting drenched. So we ran into the visitor center and we hung out there for a while, hoping that the storm would let up because we really wanted to go see it. And, you know, we were in there chatting with the ranger for about an hour till he got really tired of us, and the rain never let up. So we left. But We went back the next year in November. And as Matt said, even though the visitor center was closed, we were able to do the hike that we have done there is right off of the visitor center. And it has the largest collection of structures. It's called the Square Tower Group Hike. It's a loop trail that runs about 2 miles around the rim of this canyon.
You can do it counterclockwise and go around the canyon, see all the archaeological sites, and then come back clockwise. That's probably makes it about 3 miles in total if you do it that way. But you also then don't have to descend into the canyon. There's really zero elevation change.
Right.
Or you can do it as a loop. And when you do it clockwise or counterclockwise, you go about 80 to 100 feet down into the canyon through some trees, and that's interesting down there, and then back up the other side.
Right.
So you get a sense of what the people who would have lived in this area would experience if they're in the canyon also.
Mm-hmm. I particularly loved there was a square tower, which is how this got its name, and that was really cool. And then the other one was Hovenweep Castle, and those were some pretty great remains that were left too. I think those were my two favorite places to see on that hike.
And in good shape.
Yes, very well preserved.
There's crumbling that's going on, but pretty well preserved. These really aren't cliff dwellings.
No.
These are stacked stones, stacked onto flat ground, but on the edge of the cliffs of the canyon. But they're not built into the side of a cliff like a Mesa Verde.
Right. They're very different. Now, there are some other sites you can visit that are part of Hovenweep, but they require a short drive down some pretty primitive roads. We decided to go to one last summer, which is called Cutthroat Castle. And gosh, it seemed like it was in the middle of nowhere, didn't it?
Well, that's because it is in the middle of nowhere. And it was also like 110 degrees, I think, that day. We almost died just walking the 100 yards to the site.
We did. We had a hard time finding it. But then when we did find it, it was pretty cool to see. Again, no one was out there. We never saw another car. The only thing is we did hear that Cutthroat Castle is currently closed to visitors. I think that's temporary while they work out some access issues.
Yeah, it's like we said, it literally is in the middle of nowhere, and it's kind of a remote access, and they're still working out the details of the people who own the land around it so that people can get there safely.
Mm-hmm. Two quick notes I have also. There is a campground that's open year-round that has 31 campsites, first come, first served only. And also, Hovenweep is designated an international dark sky park, so another really great place to stargaze.
If we go from Hovenweep, go back to Highway 191 and then go north up towards Moab and pass just a little bit, we come to another place that is great to visit if you're on a national parks tour in southern Utah, which is Dead Horse Point State Park.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, Utah has some of the greatest state parks. If you're visiting Arches National Park and Canyonlands, you definitely want to take a trip to Dead Horse Point.
Right. It's about 32 miles west of Moab. Mm-hmm. It's really the same road that you're going to take to the Island in the Sky district of Canyonlands National Park. So if you're going there, you're going to drive right past the turnoff to Dead Horse Point State Park. I always want to call it Dead Horse State Park.
So the defining feature of the park, the reason that people go there, is to see this spectacular panoramic view from Dead Horse Point. And it's of the Colorado River sort of winding its way around this. Well, I guess it's kind of a gooseneck, isn't
it? It's a meander.
It's a meander.
I don't think you get a full gooseneck view, but it's a beautiful sight.
It is. It's about 2,000 feet below where this overlook is. And it's gorgeous. You can see for miles. And so some people drive in just to see this view and take some photos. But you can also hike. There are like 7 miles of trails.
Yeah, it's not a huge park. The trail that we took along the rim there, it wasn't that long. I don't know, maybe We went 2 or 3 miles out, but saw great views along the way.
Mm-hmm. This is also an international dark sky park. Actually, I would just wonder if all these parks in Utah are. Maybe we should have issued a blanket statement at the beginning. But they also have, they have two campgrounds there. And what's cool, and we haven't checked these out yet, is that they have 9 new yurts in the campground that you can rent overnight. And if you don't know what a yurt is, how would you describe it, Matt? Like a round?
Well, it's a round structure that's canvas covered. So there's a physical superstructure like wooden beams that has canvas stretched over them. We haven't seen the ones at Dead Horse Point State Park. I'm guessing they're very similar to the ones at another park we'll talk about in a minute, Goblin Valley.
Mm-hmm.
The ones we saw in Goblin Valley, they had doors and window insulated windows.
Yeah,
I think they're pretty nice. And these
right.
are the ones at Dead Horse Point State Park are fairly new. I think it's pretty deserted out there, so you know, be prepared to entertain yourself.
Right. I would love to check those out. And if you want more information about their schedule and prices, those are available to reserve on reserveamerica.com.
Yeah, so check out that if you're in the Moab area or Canyonlands, the Island and Sky area. Dead Horse Point State Park is something you should check out.
Mm-hmm. Now we're going to talk about one of my favorites. Not, I shouldn't say that because they're all my favorites, but this one is especially my favorite. Goblin Valley State Park.
12 miles north of Hanksville.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, everyone knows where Hanksville is.
Right. Middle of nowhere, Hanksville.
Again, you'll have to Google it because we'll get the directions wrong. But kind of in the middle of nowhere, but super cool landscape.
Mm-hmm.
This is an area where the rock is just so, and the erosion was just right that it created these, for lack of better description, goblin-shaped, like, small hoodoos.
Yeah, well, they're sort of mushroom-shaped.
Mushroom, mm-hmm. yeah. They kind of look like goblins. But it's a beautiful area to hike through and just surreal. Like, I mean, about as close as you're going to get to some kind of other planet, you know, moonwalk kind of situation.
Mm-hmm. Right. A couple things that I love. One is you can wander wherever you want. You do not have to be on a trail. So you're just, there's this huge area of these goblins and you just wander amongst them. And I know this is weird, but I always think of them. So some of them are really small, like a couple of feet tall. And even the big ones aren't probably more than what, maybe 8 feet tall. They look like families to me. They look like there's the mom, dad, and there's the little kids. And I don't know, it's like this, these families of goblins. And I think it's definitely a magical place.
It's not a huge park. It's about 3,600 acres. Big enough you can get lost, but small enough that if you did get lost, you just keep walking in circles and eventually, because there's a little bit of an elevation change, you can see the parking lot.
Right.
You'll eventually walk past a goblin and see the parking lot off into the distance. So I don't think people are going to get lost in the outer reaches of this park.
No. And again, it could be a quick visit if you wanted it to be, because as Matt just said, you drive to the parking area and you head down a little bit of elevation into this big area and they're right there. So you don't have to hike a long way to get to the goblins. And it's a pretty popular place. I think the last statistic I saw was about 60,000 visitors a year. That's kind of a lot for a little state park in the middle of nowhere.
And they have a well-kept campground there with the sites look, you know, we've been there in the off season. The sites look clean and orderly, and it'd be a great place to camp. They also have a couple of yurts.
I think two.
And when we were there one time, again in the off season, the Department of Natural Resource staff was out there fixing a deck and I think replacing a window, and they let us in to see the inside of the yurt they were working on. And they're nice.
They are nice. It was fun to see the inside, and we took some pictures. Again, we'll post those because we had no idea what it would look like on the inside. But I mean, there are beds and table, and I mean, it looked very comfortable. So it's definitely a place we'd like to stay when we go back.
Now, we should mention that Goblin Valley State Park is at the south, kind of southeast side of this bigger land area called the San Rafael Swell.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, I'm not even sure you would notice it from just driving by. It's essentially like this plateau, this swell of land. And of course, over millions of years, the water and wind has eroded the edges of this swell. And wherever that happens, it creates these, you know, pretty cool slot canyons and places where you can hike. And so on the southeastern kind of stretch of the San Rafael Swell, there's a series of hikes. And one of our favorite hikes that we've done in the area was Little Wild Horse Canyon.
Right, right.
Now, we did it as a loop. Then this is, gosh, maybe 5-minute drive to the trailhead from Goblin Valley State Park. And you can go up this slot canyon. When we got to the back side of it, then connected to another trail called, what was the Bell?
Mm-hmm, Bell Canyon.
Bell Canyon, and came back, and beautiful, beautiful slot canyon.
Mm-hmm. And that, to do that whole loop with both canyons was about a 9-mile round trip hike. Now, of course, you could just wander into Little Wild Horse Canyon and you know, go for a mile or two, because it gets spectacular right at the beginning. Now, these are very popular places, especially amongst families, because it's easy for little kids to go in there. But there are other slightly more technical slots over there. I know there's one called Ding and Dang that people have told us about. But it's funny, because when we were at Goblin Valley in the visitor center, we were talking to a ranger and we were asking him for slot canyon suggestions over there. And he mentioned a few others. And then he looked at us and he said something along the lines of, but when you go in these other ones, you need to know your hiking partner very well. I thought, that's kind of an odd thing to say. Like, and I think what he sort of explained was like, you're going to have to push their butt up and all that kind of thing.
A lot of boosting?
A lot of boosting going on. I think that's what he meant. Didn't you take it to mean that?
That kind of creeped me out a little bit, so I didn't think about it anymore. But
I wasn't too worried, since I know you very well. I'm not sure I'd want to go with, you know, somebody else. But
well, like we said at the beginning, this is an example of when we go out and do things in Southern Utah, we come back with a longer list of things to do than we started. And that whole series of slot canyons in that area, we got to go back and do. Now, we should say, and this goes for any slot canyon, you know, especially in the Southwest, but anywhere in the world, really have to check the weather forecast and be aware of impending rain. And, you know, sometimes it's not in the forecast, but these slot canyons can be dangerous. They can be deadly if flash floods come through.
I think the thing that we have started to do now, and I would advise this for anyone, is before you go in, visit a ranger station or park visitor center, whatever it is they have close by. So Hanksville has a ranger station. And I would suggest going in there and saying, hey, we're going to go hike Little Wild Horse Canyon today. What do you think? And get their advice. You know, they have a lot more information. And sometimes even, we're going to talk about this in a minute, but sometimes these slots are flooded from a previous storm. So I would highly recommend that you look at the forecast and talk to a ranger.
Right. And the ranger there at Goblin Valley State Park, which is very, very close, they would probably also know what the weather forecast is for that day.
Mm-hmm. Next up on the list is Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument. And this area of land is managed by the BLM.
It's a big area.
It's a big, wide,
spread out area. Mm-hmm. We've been in there several times. It seems like we've done a lot, but there's a lot left for us to do in Escalante, some of which involves going down long, kind of rough roads.
Right.
But we'll talk about a couple of things that are pretty easy to access. First of all, one of the most popular hikes in the whole area is Lower Calf Creek Falls.
Mm-hmm. And for good reason.
And there is an Upper Calf Creek Falls, and those trails, you got to start each of those trails from a different place. So if if you're going down lower Calf Creek Falls, it doesn't like turn into upper Calf Creek Falls.
Right. They're two separate hikes. But lower Calf Creek is about 5.5 miles round trip. And at the end, you arrive at the lower section of Calf Creek Falls. It's about a 126-foot waterfall, and it's beautiful. And it falls into this, I guess you'd call it sort of a small lake. And we were there in November, so it was a little bit chilly. But we've heard that in the summer, people are swimming in that lake and under the waterfall and kind of cooling off after the hike. You know, what's funny is that we've heard of Calf Creek Falls over and over and over again because people love it and they recommend it. We didn't want to go to it because of its popularity. Usually we don't like to go to the super popular places. But again, we were there in the off season and it was great. And we hardly saw anybody. I mean, there were a handful of people. So it was definitely worth it.
We should say that there is a BLM visitor center in the town of Escalante.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice, looks pretty new visitor center. Folks in there can give you all the information you need about things to do. So that should really be a stop, your first stop, mm-hmm. if you're planning anything.
That's right. And there are folks there from the National Forest Service, too, because this land is also surrounded by National Forest. And so the cute little town of Escalante, where this visitor center is, that's where we usually stay. It's very tiny, but there are some good places to stay. And there is our favorite outdoor store / restaurant.
Right. You could get your outdoor supplies and a pizza.
That's right. It's called Escalante Outfitters. And so they have great food and you can get some hiking socks.
And we've stayed at the Circle D Motel, which is great. We've stayed at Escalante Cabins, mm-hmm. which is across the street from the visitor center. So great place to stay and definitely go in the visitor center to get information. One of the things to do in the National Monument we need to do more of is drive down that hole in the rock road.
Mm-hmm.
And it goes for a long way. I think it goes all the way to the border of Glen Canyon.
It does.
National Recreation Area.
Yeah. The last couple miles are in Glen Canyon. It's 62 miles. Now, it's a dirt road. We haven't gone all the way, but people say the last several miles are really rough and you definitely need four-wheel drive. But the parts that we've been on haven't been bad at all. One of the things, there are a lot of great hikes that branch off from Hole in the Rock Road. One of our favorites is a slot canyon called Zebra Canyon.
You park close to the road. It's a fairly flat hike to begin with. There's really not a lot of elevation change Mm-mm. to that hike. Now, it's about a 5-mile round trip. And so at the end of, maybe 2.5 miles, you kind of get to a wash. You have to be looking for it, but there's a series of slot canyons. Zebra Canyon is off this wash, and
mm-hmm.
you kind of take a look at it and think, well, this must not be it because I'm not sure I can fit through that first section. That's what I like about slot canyons. I have to know the night before how much pizza to eat before I go into those things. But
I think you were afraid when you took your backpack off and started going sideways. You were afraid you were going to get stuck.
When you have to take your belt off to get the extra eighth of an inch clearance to get through, you know that's a danger sign. But that particular slot canyon, it's narrow, but I think that very first section was the most narrow. So once we got in there,
mm-hmm.
we didn't have any more super tight squeezes.
No, it's definitely narrow and it's a short little slot canyon. The whole thing is maybe 1/4 mile long, so it doesn't take very long to get to the end. But when you get, I don't know, maybe halfway, these stripes start appearing on the sandstone walls of the canyon and they look just like zebra stripes. And that's how it got its name, Zebra Canyon.
Yeah, we have a little video that we'll put a link to filming you squeezing through this canyon.
Was I swearing?
You were. I've edited out some of it. I can't edit out all your swearing. But
that would be impossible.
We'll put a link to that on our website.
Yeah, we didn't realize when we went. So when we were there, the canyon itself was completely dry. You know, there was no water to be seen. But we've read since then people's trip reports, and they said they have waded through waist deep water in there, which is kind of crazy to think about. I wouldn't do it.
I don't wade through stagnant water
ever.
if it's been sitting there for more than a couple days.
But there is also another slot canyon off that same road called Spooky that we did that on another trip. And that, again, that's another really narrow one. If you have claustrophobia at all, these probably are not for you.
That is one where we turned around.
I know.
Because I kind of got into a squeeze and couldn't go forward, couldn't go backwards, and I thought, that's it.
Yeah, it was pretty tight. Plus, there were clouds were starting to appear above us, and we were freaked out about the possibility of a flash flood. And so, literally, I mean, there's no way to get out quickly of these places. So we just decided we'd had enough of Spooky.
But we
got spooked and spooky. But again, so many things to do in Escalante. We've just barely scratched the surface on that.
Now, if you go west of there, past Bryce, past Zion, kind of north of Zion, is another cool national monument that we didn't know about until we had been in southern Utah 4 or 5 times, called Cedar Breaks National Monument.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes you'll see photos of Cedar Breaks, and your first reaction is, oh, isn't Bryce Canyon beautiful with all the hoodoos? And it's not as big, but it looks very similar to Bryce Canyon.
It does.
In places.
Mm-hmm. One of the differences is from Bryce Canyon is, so it's a 3-mile-long amphitheater, and it has all the same incredible spires that Bryce does, and pinnacles and arches and hoodoos. But it's 2,000 feet below the canyon rim, and you cannot hike down there like you can at Bryce. So when you're there, you're up on the rim of the amphitheater looking down. There are hikes up there, but there are no hikes into the canyon.
And it's at elevation. It's like 10,000 feet at the top. And one cool thing about Cedar Breaks National Monument is that because of that elevation, it has bristlecone pine trees.
I know. I think we mentioned that in a previous episode about the parks that have bristlecone pine trees, which are the oldest trees on the planet.
Right. So you have to watch the weather. Being at 10,000 feet, the visitor center and that road is generally open from about May to October. Because they can get a lot of snow up there.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're there and it's marked and you think you're going to run up there to see Cedar Breaks, it's probably not going to happen. So be aware of the road conditions.
Right. The park is closed in the winter as far as visitor center and restrooms, but and part of the road is closed, but you can go and participate in some winter activities if you like. So you can snowshoe in or cross-country ski or even snowmobile into the park in the winter. So that would be fun to do. We've never done that before. And if you're looking for a good hiking trail, so what we did when we were there, we did the Spectra Point and Ramparts Overlook Trails. It's 2 miles round trip, but we continued on to the Ramparts Overlook, which was another 2 miles in addition to that.
And you're always, along this entire trail, you're looking into this amphitheater.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting different views of the amphitheater as you're going down this trail.
Mm-hmm. They have a campground there called Point Supreme. Has 25 campsites, and you can reserve those on recreation.gov.
Some of them. You can reserve like 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think they reserve the other 15 for walk-ins. So if you don't get one online, you can always take your chances of getting a walk-in.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but Cedar Breaks is definitely worth a stop, especially if you're in the area of Zion and Bryce. We'd highly recommend a trip to Cedar Breaks. Is this our last one now? Buckskin Gulch.
Isn't it last? We saved the
the best maybe for last.
Maybe the best for last. At Buckskin Gulch is one of my favorite hikes ever.
I know. You've always loved that one. And we've been there like, what, 3 times now? So Buckskin Gulch is the longest slot canyon in the world. That's its claim to fame.
And, well, it's managed by the BLM.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that means it's all BLM land. It's part of the Paria Canyon. The Vermilion Cliff Wilderness area is right there.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, as you're going to Buckskin Gulch, it's right by the hike you take, the trail that you take to the Wave.
Right, right. It's right over there, right on the Utah-Arizona border.
between Page, Arizona, and Kanab, Utah.
Mm-hmm. Right. So you could stay in either town and have fairly easy access to Buckskin Gulch. So what we do when we've been there is we park at the Wire Pass Trailhead Parking, and we go out into the Slot Canyon for, I don't know, maybe 5 miles or so, you know, see it's gorgeous, have some lunch, and then we turn around and we go back to our car. But what a lot of people do is they want to see the whole Buckskin Gulch. So you can leave one car at the White House campground, drive your other car to the Wire Pass Trailhead, hike the entire thing, which is about a little over 20 miles to, you know, to where your car is at the White House, and then drive back. So that's the way, that would take all day, obviously. That's the way people who want to see the whole thing do it.
Multiple days.
Or camp, sure. Yeah, people can camp too. So this particular hike, the whole Buckskin Gulch, Backpacker Magazine named it the most dangerous hike in the U.S., and that is because if it rains and there's a flash flood, there is no way to get out.
Right. There's a part of the Slot Canyon, which is the part that we always hike through, where there's nowhere for 7 or 8 miles that you could get out. So if flash flood came through, it's going to get you. There's no way to climb to elevation, get out of the way. So this in particular is an area that you have to know what the weather forecast is.
Right.
If you're in there and a flash flood comes through, you are out of luck.
Yeah. And these flash floods aren't just a fluke. I mean, I read that they have about 8 flash floods a year that run through Buckskin Gulch. And it's interesting because every time that happens, it completely changes the look of the canyon, right? Because new log jams will appear, and all of a sudden there'll be a choke stone where there wasn't one before, and huge boulders. So every time those floods come through, it deposits things, and it's a different canyon after that.
And when you're in the canyon, you are reminded of these flash floods every now and then because you can look up and you can see a log that's maybe 20, 30, 40 feet high that's lodged between the two walls of the canyon. And most of the area in this particular Slot Canyon, the walls are 10, 15, 20 feet apart.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see a log that's lodged up there. And the only way that log could have gotten up there is part of a flash flood.
Right, right. And I will say that this particular Slot Canyon does not have those narrow squeezes like we were just talking about for Zebra and Spooky. You don't have to go sideways and squeeze through any really tight spots. But you might have to wade through stagnant pools. So it's funny because the first time we ever did it, it was bone dry as far as we went. Remember, there wasn't a drop of water in there.
Right. No standing water of any kind.
Uh-huh. But the second time.
Oh, we ran into water right away.
Right.
And these, it was green.
Yeah. These pools are pretty putrid. Well, is that a good word to describe it?
A lot of things living in there.
Slimy and stagnant and greenish. And yeah, it looks like there's a lot of stuff growing in there that you don't want to wade through. But a lot of people do it. A lot of people wade through them.
Again, you can talk to – there's a couple of BLM visitor centers, one in the town of Kanab, and then one off of the highway that's not far from the trailhead. And they can give you a sense of maybe how much water is in the gulch.
Yes. They can tell you before you take all the time to drive down this dirt road and hike into the gulch. And before you invest the time and the energy, you should definitely check at the ranger station, and they'll tell you if it's flooded or not because they know how many storms have come through. And they said it takes a long time to dry out, as you can imagine.
The wet season for that part of the country is late July and then August and September. That's the monsoon season.
Mm-hmm.
People have asked us, since we say we've hiked it when there's absolutely no water, what time of year it was. This isn't a guarantee, but it was early June.
Mm-hmm.
It was hot. It wasn't that hot in the canyon because there's shade. But they must have had a dry winter and spring. And it was before the monsoon season. So that might be a better time, May, June-ish. to hit it to avoid some of the water.
Right. So as I said before, we've hiked about 5 miles of it maybe and then turned around. And that seemed very manageable to us. But I was reading about if you continue further. And I just wanted to mention that this one blog post I read said that if you hike about 7.5 miles from the trailhead, you come to what they have named the cesspool. And I guess it's water that is pretty much always there. And hikers have had to wade through neck deep stagnant water for about 150 feet. So that is something to watch out for if you want to hike the whole thing. And the other one I wanted to mention is about 12 miles in, there is a big obstacle. It's a 15 to 18 foot drywall that you descend.
Drywall along the canyon.
That would make it
canyon.
Easier to
it's
descend.
It's a little weird, but.
It's a dry fall, and you descend it with the help of a rope, which I guess someone has affixed there, and there are some steps that are chipped into the rock. So it's just something to be aware of that you're going to come to that at some point if you want to do the whole thing.
So two other things to mention. Mm-hmm. We always talk about parking at the Wire Pass trailhead, and we hike then down this Wire Pass wash, and you get to this Slot Canyon, which is beautiful, that's maybe a couple hundred yards long. And a lot of times people think that's Buckskin Gulch, but that's just...
That's Wire Pass.
That's just Wire Pass, mm-hmm. and it's beautiful. But that just leads you to Buckskin. The other thing is as you're driving south on House Rock Valley Road, there is a turnoff to the Buckskin Gulch Trailhead.
Mm-hmm.
We don't take that one because... And you can park there and go right into Buckskin Gulch. That first few miles isn't really as interesting
right.
as the area that you go to when you do Wire Pass and then go into Buckskin Gulch. So just a note, you can do it either way. It's perfectly fine.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is what we get this question, like, why do we like slot canyons?
Mm-hmm.
And when you're in those canyons, because they're so narrow, even on a sunny day, the light doesn't get directly to the bottom. And when you're taking photos, the light is bouncing off of the sides of the rocks, and the colors are incredible. It's a lot like what we described when we went through the Narrows in Zion Canyon, when mm-hmm. we hiked that. And so the photograph opportunities are just incredible, and of course, just even if you're not taking photographs, just the visual of going through these canyons is spectacular.
Oh, my gosh. It's beautiful. Yeah, that's one thing after we've said all this, we didn't say how incredibly spectacular this canyon is. But it's gorgeous. And again, it's just mile after mile. We're not talking about a quarter mile Zebra Canyon. We're talking about every time you round a corner, this new vista is in front of you, this beautiful slot. Another thing, too, I wanted to mention – you purchase a sort of a parking pass at Wire Pass Trailhead. You need to bring $6 with you. You purchase that and put it on your car window. But other than that, you do not need a permit to hike Buckskin. If you're going to camp, there are very specific sites where you can camp, and you do need to set that up ahead of time. You need a permit for that.
You have to put the $6 in an envelope and stick it in the slot. So mm-hmm. we've been there many times where all I've had is a 20 on me, and you know, so that's fine. It's a voluntary donation to the BLM. But if you want to pay it, and this is another tip as we're driving through all of these parks, we always have a wad of ones with us because mm-hmm. you never know what you're going to run into a small parking fee, and you want to be able to pay it. So
right. So on all of these, we did not mention specifically directions and hours and all kinds of things like that because it's all so easily accessible on the internet, and we just don't have time to go into all those kinds of details. So you can Google any of these places that we talked about and get more information.
And things change.
Right.
Change, mm-hmm. Road might be washed out, and so a mm-hmm. direction we give you today might not be right 3 years from now. So anyway, online these days, you can get all that information.
Right. So again, we hope that as you're exploring the Mighty Five National Parks, that you'll keep some of these other national monuments and other parks and public lands in mind to explore, because there is just, there's a wealth of places in Utah. Did you want to mention our PDF?
Yeah, we did a little write-up, maybe a couple years ago. Anyway, mm-hmm. we called it the 20 Amazing Places to visit when you're in southern Utah that are outside the five national parks. And it gives a little bit more detail about where it is. And that PDF, we'll put a link to it on our website.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of a nice little reference tool. And there's a little map on it that shows where all these places are. So we'll make that resource available also.
That's right. To all of you who are wondering if you can see the Mighty Five in Utah in 1 week, the answer to that is you probably can, but why would you? I think Utah needs many, many, many trips to fully see all these amazing places.
Yeah, I agree.
You know what it's time for?
It's time for the warm-up.
No, mailbag.
Oh.
Where are you?
I don't know. Mailbag.
What do you think we've been doing all these hours?
recording the podcast, and now it's time for the mailbag?
Yes. Yes, it's time for the mailbag.
Your favorite part of the show.
Mm-hmm. It is. It is my favorite. So today's question that I chose comes from Nancy in Fort Collins, Colorado. And she wrote in and she wants to know how we met.
How we met. We should record these separately without listening to each other. And then they just have the producer like put them back to back and see how close they match.
That's right. See if we tell the same story, because we have completely different remembrances.
Well, I don't think you don't remember. You don't remember us meeting.
Well, that's the problem.
Several times.
Why don't you tell it, Matt?
Well, we were both at the University of Kansas back in the early 80s, and it was in August. So back then, the University of Kansas would have students come a week early to do administrative stuff like sign up for classes and buy books and all stuff that would take about 37 minutes, but you would have to come a week early. And so that spare time during that week, it was actually called Country Club Week,
mm-hmm.
and you got to know your fellow students.
Right. It basically was one big party.
It was one big party. And mm-hmm. it also happened to be your 20th birthday.
Right.
And we met the old-fashioned way. In a bar.
That's correct.
This particular day, it's your birthday, you were there with a girlfriend, and I was with a guy friend of mine, and we happened to be the only four people in this little bar that was close to campus, and you were with your girlfriend celebrating your birthday. Mm-hmm. And we talked and had a lovely conversation. You were very friendly to me. I thought that was great. Thought it went very well until the next night. I ran into you at another party, and you had no recollection of me.
Well, in my defense, it was a long night. We went to a lot of bars, a lot of parties, and I met a lot of people. Not that you
this
didn't
was last
stand...
night, or this was the night of your 20th birthday.
On my 20th birthday.
I see. Mm. And then, so that was, I felt, okay, that I get it. You wouldn't remember me. So we had a lot of nice, long conversation. However, the third night, I see you at another bar and said, hello, Karen. And you were a little concerned because you didn't know who I was or why I knew your name. So I thought that was really great that now, after two nights of meeting you, the third night you had no recollection of me. So I have a rule. I only beg three times.
But it only took three times.
Well, good, because that was the limit.
I remember that third night I was walking to the restroom in the bar and I passed by you. You were talking to some other girls and you looked at me and you said, hello, Karen.
Oh, yeah, I'm not just waiting around. I mean, got to keep the pipeline going.
You snooze, you lose.
You're on your third chance. So.
And I just remember when you looked at me and said, "Hi, Karen," I thought, wow, who is that cute boy who knows my name? And it stuck from that night. From the third night, that was it. That was it. And you asked for my phone number because back then, of course, that's what you had to do, right? We just had the old-fashioned phones in our apartments. No one had a cell phone.
Phones.
And you asked for my phone number. You waited a week to call me. I think that was like a punishment.
No, that was just... It took me a while to. It took me three nights to find your phone number. That's what I do.
That's true.
And then almost just a little bit more than 2 years after that, we were married.
Right. We were engaged a year later.
Right.
And married a year after that. So it was, you know, once you know, you know. And when you meet the right person, I think it all becomes clear.
Yeah. So that was like, what, about 72 years ago, I think?
And look at us now.
And now we're the recording podcast. It's all gone very well.
Happily ever after. If you have a question for us, you can send us an email to mattandkarensmith@gmail.com or reach out to us on social media. Go to facebook.com/dearbobandess. Or you can find us on Instagram at mattandkarensmith. We'll review all the questions that come in and we'll be answering some of them in our mailbag segment on future episodes.
To see pictures of the 10 places we talked about today, go to www.thedearbobandsuepodcast.com. And click on the title for episode 11. There you'll find the show notes for this episode and links to other information.
Thank you to all of you who've already given us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. We are at 277.
Wow, I didn't know that.
Yes.
That's great.
I know. It's really great. But we'd love to get to 300. So if you haven't left us a review yet, we sure would appreciate it if you did. Now, you can leave a review on Apple Podcasts, even if you listened to this episode on Google, Spotify, or another podcast app.
The books that this podcast is based on are available on Amazon.com. Just search for Dear Bob and Sue. And you can also find more information about us by heading over to www.dearbobandsue.com.
Our show is produced by the amazing team at Puddle Creative in Portland, Oregon, who has to make us sound good every other week. Our artwork is by the designers at Expert Subjects, and our theme music is by Will West. Maybe next time we go to Buckskin Gulch, we'll make it to the cesspool.
Well, we might make it there. But I think that's about as far as I'm going.
You're not wading through?
No, you can't. You can report back to me how it was.
I'll go first.